The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
Here's the idea for the next 10 pods. We can do Paddy's little holiday review. 40 minutes of review.
Like Catherine Thomas here, no frontiers.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
Now, very happy to welcome our next guest to the show. He's written a brilliant book, I have to say. Thoroughly enjoyed it. This one comes recommended. I guarantee you, you'll enjoy this. It's The War, Hagler Hearns and Three Rounds for the Ages. I'll hold it up there for any of you watching. Don Stradley, you're very welcome, Don. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad you had a chance to read the book. That's great.
Hagler Hearns, why go back? Why revisit? Obviously, it's iconic. These things, sometimes you wonder if there's a reason to go back and revisit and what more can be said. And seems you found plenty, but what enticed you to do so?
Well, do you want the whole story or a brief story? How much time do you have?
We've got time. I mean, depends how long the whole story is, but we've got time.
I'd written a few books for a publisher here in Massachusetts, where I live, and we were kicking ideas around. We didn't know what the next book would be. And then one afternoon, he called me out of the blue and he said, what would you think about Hagler Hearns? And my first instinct was no, I didn't really want to write about Hagler Hearns. I thought it, like you said, there had already been enough. You know, I thought it was an iconic fight and I didn't think I could really add anything to it. But I slept on it for a day or two, and I started thinking that it was such an important fight. I had fond memories of going to a theater to watch it in Boston, because I lived not far from where Hagler had lived, and the Boston Garden was presenting the fight on closed circuit. So I had fond memories of the fight, and also I love that time period in boxing, 1985, as I tried to illustrate in the book. That was a really pivotal time in boxing. Things were starting to change. Sugar Ray Leonard had gone into retirement, and it didn't seem like boxing had a superstar. It had a lot of guys who were not quite at that superstar level, and there was a real sort of anticipation of who will step up to replace Ray Leonard, you know. And Muhammad Ali was gone. A lot of the big stars from just a few years earlier, Ray Mancini, Jerry Cooney, they all had sort of become passé. There was no one who was really considered the next bright star. So that Hagler Hearns fight came along at the right time to really recreate interest in boxing. So I had a lot of things to work with, and that was what motivated me. And I contacted my publisher and I said, okay, let's go. I'll give it a shot. And I'm very pleased with it.
Time moves on. I guess lots of people watching this interview didn't watch the fight live, you know, and I've watched it retrospectively, or maybe not at all. And I certainly had Hagler Hearns in my kind of lexicon just as a sports fan before I ever saw the fight, you know. And you make the point late on in the book that it was such an instant classic and it became immediately embedded in popular culture. You know, you cite numerous examples. Michael J. Fox is on one of the late night shows and you know, he's talking about the next movie he wants to direct and he's saying, oh, you know, it'll be, well, what he's trying to say is action-packed, but he says it'll be like Hagler Hearns, or you have hockey fights described as well. It was like Hagler Hearns on ice. Instant classic. What surprised me the first time I ever watched Hagler Hearns, without knowing much about it, was that we're talking about an 8-minute fight. I just assumed something so classic had gone the 12 rounds or the 15 rounds, whichever. Oh, yeah. I guess it was changing at the time. So I remember being struck by the fact that this thing wasn't like this epic that went to the very end. It was 8 of the most extraordinary minutes. So for people still who maybe haven't seen the fight, give them a sense, maybe, Don, of why this was so extraordinary. What was it about this fight? Why should people go to YouTube and watch this fight?
Well, when you remove it 35, 36 years later, you don't realize how big of an event it turned out to be. because at that time, coverage of boxing was starting to change as well, because pay-per-view was starting to become a factor, you know, and as I mentioned in the book, in fact, I think I gave it a whole chapter, they didn't know if they should show this fight on pay-per-view or at theaters on closed circuit television, which was sort of beginning to fade at the time. It was considered a bit old school. But Bob Arum, the promoter, had always had good luck with closed circuit screening. But to get back to your point, Bob Arum sent these two fighters out on this cross-country promotional tour before the fight that lasted a few weeks. And that was really unheard of for two fighters to just hit Boston, New York, Chicago, St. Louis, you know, Los Angeles, Las Vegas. I think they hit 21 or 23 cities day by day by day, meeting with the press. Now, of course, nowadays you don't have to do that. You could just have, you know, a massive kind of press conference and, you know, the entire world would see it. But in 1985, Hagler and Hearns went across the country. And every morning you'd pick up your newspaper and right there in the sports section, you would see, oh, Hagler and Hearns, today they're in Denver, Colorado, you know, and they called each other names. And it became this sort of daily event of following these guys across the country. It was very old school at the time. It seemed almost like an old time vaudeville theatrical act that they were taking across the country, but it worked. And it got people very interested in this fight. And at the time, people weren't anticipating a great fight. They thought it would be a good fight, you know. But this publicity tour, it turned America into boxing fans, which hadn't been the case for a few years since the retirement of Ali and then Ray Leonard. Boxing had dipped in popularity. And the networks on television were showing boxing on the weekends, but the mainstream had kind of lost interest in boxing. And it was the publicity for this fight that really put it over. So with so much anticipation, the fact that these fighters tore into each other the way they did, it was unprecedented. Big fights, as you know, if you followed boxing, big fights rarely live up to the buildup. This one did 10 times over. And I think that is why it became such a historical moment in not just boxing, but in all sports. Because back then, I know with American coverage, when a boxing event was being produced, they would bring in football players and commentators from mainstream sports to kind of present it, trying very hard to bring in the fans of mainstream sports. So if you were a football fan, you'd see if there'd be a famous football player as part of the production. You'd be standing there with a microphone interviewing people at the arena, you know. And so they tried to make it all encompassing. So it was more than a fight. It was a big mainstream kind of event.
Yeah. Yeah, this was not a feel out your opponent for two or three rounds kind of an encounter. So the two protagonists are very interesting in their own ways and for different reasons. And you spend a fair portion of the book charting their rise and what makes them interesting. So if we start with Marvin Hagler, I thought in particular he was a complicated figure. And you rightly talk about Leonard and his retirement. And so Ali hands the baton of superstardom to Leonard and he goes. And then who's left? And Hagler comes through in the 70s. He's world champion. But say by the turn of the 80s, he's a brilliant fighter. He's a talented fighter. He is tough as nails. And yet there is a bitterness to him, I would say. He's often complaining about things. He doesn't feel he has got the respect or the publicity that he deserves. He's approaching, you know, 30, 31 years of age. And you say in the book at one stage, the difference between the genius middleweight and the embittered civilian was vast. Now, through the 80s and the build up to this fight that we're talking about, he does start to get bigger paydays and a touch more publicity. But this is a frustrated figure who doesn't know how to be a star, who doesn't have star quality, who is not getting the recognition or the paydays he deserves, and just doesn't sound like a character comfortable with himself or how life is going in many respects.
He was in a difficult era because when he started out, Muhammad Ali was still boxing. And there was only room for Muhammad Ali, it seemed. Anyone else was sort of way on the back burner. You know, there might have been Roberto Duran, a couple of other guys, but it was just Ali all the time, you know. So first he was in Ali's shadow in a way. Then he was in Leonard's shadow. The problem that Hagler faced also was that he was not a ticket seller in those early years. He was just sort of an obscure fighter. Even in his own home area, he was receiving publicity from the local press. That's the interesting thing. The local press thought, this is a story. We have this great fighter, and he's not getting the recognition. Hmm. So they would do a lot of articles on Hagler. It was very impressive the way the Boston press really gravitated toward Hagler. But I think it had an opposite effect, because every time they interviewed him, he was bitter. He was always complaining that he wasn't getting the recognition. And I think he turned people off. Mm. People didn't want to hear that this guy was complaining. They wanted to see, you know, Ray Leonard, who seemed to have fun every day. You know, they wanted their superstars to look like they were enjoying life, enjoying their money, you know. And Hagler just had this perpetual scowl. And the interesting thing for me was that I got to know his trainers over the years, because I wrote for The Ring magazine for many years. And I got to know Marvin's trainers, the Petronelli brothers, especially Goody. And Goody would tell me it was almost a crime that people never got to know what a nice guy Marvin Hagler really was. He says he would put on that face when he was in public. He would put on this sour face because he thought that was what people wanted. They wanted him to be this angry, tough guy. He said people never got to know him as a nice guy. And there are some people in the book who mentioned that he was a nice guy, very loyal, very personable, but he was never comfortable with the public. He could talk to you one-on-one, you know, if you happen to run into him in a bar room. I've heard this story. If you met Hagler in a bar room and sat down next to him, he would talk to you one-on-one. Mm. But the minute a second person showed up or a third person, he would become very uncomfortable. He did not like that a big crowd. He just like, yeah, maybe one or two people have a little conversation. He did not love the massive crowd that stardom could bring. So even though he craved stardom, he didn't wear it well. It bothered him in the long run.
Yes. It didn't help he was fighting on HBO, which was obviously just getting going at the time. Middleweight champion, his defense of his fights, he was maybe pulling in $500,000, which obviously is better than a kick in the teeth, but it's only $500,000 compared to the money of Sugar Ray and others. And even you quote Jack Craig of the Boston Globe saying of his move to HBO, you said it's both a statement about his lack of popularity or his innocence or a little bit of both. So he was stuck in HBO, and Bob Arum said around the time, you know, the problem is the middleweight division is dead. And so that's Hagler. And to be fair, things do improve in the build up to Hearns. He does get to fight, sure, you know, Roberto Duran. He gets $1 million for that. He gets $5 million for that. Sorry.
What's interesting is that he eventually became the most, the highest paid athlete in the world.
In 83, yeah.
You know, but no one knew who he was. Yeah. And that was really Bob Arum gambling. It was Bob Arum sort of stacking the deck, telling Hagler, I've got faith in you. Here's another $1 million. Stay with me. We're going to do something at some point. We're going to do something big. So he was putting money in Hagler's pocket, but Hagler was still not very popular He wanted to do the endorsements. He wanted to be on the late night talk shows, you know. And it was not happening for him.
No. And even when he started getting money, he had this incredible reputation for being tight with it.
Yeah. That was a big joke, an ongoing joke that went on.
So that's Hagler. And by the way, should mention as well, Hagler the whole time is frustrated by the quality of his opponents and is just more than anything desperate to fight Sugar Ray Leonard, who retires and is a great disappointment for Hagler. So he's a bit at sea. Tommy Hearns, the opposite in so many ways. Detroit, things come a bit easier for him and a bit more quickly for him than they do for Hagler. Like early on, for instance, in 1981, he does get the Sugar Ray fight. You know, this thing that Hagler is craving. So very early on, at like 22 years of age, Tommy Hearns gets to fight Sugar Ray, loses in the 14th round, but like gets $8 million. And that's a good start to your 20s.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Tommy Hearns to me is a very interesting character. And I don't know if you noticed in the book, but I really tried to give Hearns his due for his part in this story. You know, he's a very interesting character to me. To me, he was that sort of underprivileged kid in Detroit, in you know, really bad section of town. And when he became famous, he didn't know how to be famous. He didn't know what he was supposed to do. So he started to imitate other famous people, Michael Jackson in particular. He would hang out with Michael Jackson, and you know, Michael Jackson had some exotic pets. So Tommy Hearns would buy some exotic pets. You know, Tommy Hearns would hear that somebody had a collection of expensive cars. He would buy expensive cars. He just sort of did what he thought he was supposed to do as a famous celebrity sports figure. But on most nights, he would retire to his room and just watch Elvis Presley movies on TV, you know, or you know, if there was a party going on in his house, he would just go upstairs and hang out in his room. And you know, he was more like Hagler than maybe either one wanted to admit. He craved fame, but he also wasn't sure how to wear it, you know, and it came to him early. So I think that just gave him more problems in a way. But he also had physical problems. He had a delicate bone structure that always let him down in big fights, you know, in his right hand. He had that amazing power, but it was almost like his bones couldn't keep up with it, you know. So he had a lot to deal with. But like you said, he was more popular in Detroit than Marvin ever was popular in his own home area in Massachusetts. Tommy had a big audience, but then he had to deal with that because whenever he'd lose a fight, they would all, you know, turn on him, and he had to deal with that, winning them back, you know. So Tommy's story to me is equally as fascinating as Hagler's, and they both had a lot of pitfalls on their way to meeting each other.
And of course, he was fighting in the Kronk Gym. People won't be surprised to hear Detroit. So Manny Stewart, is he, you know, in the early 80s and beyond, is he like the jewel in the Kronk Gym? Would that be your sense?
Oh, Tommy Hearns? Absolutely. Yeah. Tommy Hearns was the sort of the fifth franchise in Detroit. You know, they had their basketball team, their football team, the hockey team. They had a lot of popular teams. And Tommy, for a while, was another sports franchise.
So you, well, it seems anyway, is my interpretation, you maybe illustrate after he fights Sugar Ray Leonard and the following couple of years, it's not like he's inactive, but there's a restlessness about him, a lot of hobbies outside of the ring. As you said, you know, he's buying exotic animals and his cougar is biting him in his hand one night, you know. So it seems like fighting Duran and this amazing, you talked about his right hand, this amazing punch, which knocks out Duran, sort of kind of puts him back on the map a little bit.
Without that Duran fight, we probably would never get Hagler Hearns.
Okay.
Because before the Duran fight, Tommy Hearns seemed like he had, you know, been to the top, lost to Leonard, and was never going to really find himself again. He had some hand injuries. His fights were becoming a little bit dull. He was going the distance with guys that he should have knocked out. There was a sense that Tommy couldn't find himself. You know, he was adrift. But when he knocked out Duran, suddenly, oh, he's the old Tommy Hearns again. That excited everybody.
Yeah.
No one took into account that, you know, Duran was an over-the-hill lightweight who, you know, was probably in over his head against Tommy Hearns. They only saw Tommy hit him and he went down and set off the fireworks. Let's get the drums going for Hagler Hearns. Without that Duran fight, which actually was not a big moneymaker, which surprised me. I vaguely remembered it as being a successful fight, but apparently from what I found out, it was a financial flop because no one really believed in Tommy anymore. They were not buying tickets to see him fight Duran.
Do you know, this is what struck me as well, because when I think of the 80s and boxing, in retrospect, it's Hagler Hearns, Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, these four kings. It's like a golden age. And yet it was kind of stunning to read your book and to realize actually it was in a little bit of trouble boxing. The viewing figures were low. The ticket sales were average. You know,
absolutely.
I mean, it's only in retrospect that, you know, you talk of Hagler Hearns in hushed tones. But in advance of April 15th, 1985, as you said, you know, something like Tommy Hearns against Roberto Duran, not a big commercial success, which is extraordinary from this vantage point.
Right, exactly. Well, the whole concept of the four kings, I've never really liked it. I always thought it diminished those guys. I thought it's kind of a shame that you can't talk about one without talking about the other three. You know, I that irritated me a little bit. And I quoted Marvin Hagler in the book saying, look, there was only one king and it was me, which is a quote I really like. But at the time, nobody called them the four kings. You know, at the time, you know, they were... you know, Leonard was inactive for much of the 80s. He was sort of fighting when he felt like it. It was in and out. Hagler could not sell tickets. Duran was unpredictable. Sometimes he'd be, you know, a colorful winning fighter. But his heyday had been 10 years before. You know, he was an over-the-hill lightweight trying to make money as a middleweight, you know. And Hearns was, he blew his two biggest fights. He was knocked out. So nobody called them the four kings back then. That came later with some, you know, looking back, you always think the good old days were better. And they of course, you know, saying this, they deserve to be called kings. They deserve all of the recognition that they get now, and they deserve to be revered and put in the Hall of Fame. But that whole idea of the four kings, it's been blown out of proportion. They struggled. They had bad fights. Their fights were not all moneymakers. Even when Hagler fought Duran, it was considered a big disappointment, both as a fight and as a box office event, because Duran was on a bit of an upswing at that point because he'd won a few fights, and Arum had big faith in Duran, not Hagler. He thought Duran was going to bring the audience, and he still didn't. So I love that aspect of the book. It's kind of like a different way of looking at that period that people have kind of put a little icing on it. You know, they tend to overestimate. It was a fun era. I loved being there. I was a young man and going to the fights and reading about the fights. I loved it. But it wasn't a golden era that people perceive it to be now.
We're talking here with Don Stradley, who's written The War about the Hagler Hearns fight, three rounds for the ages. So let's maybe jump to the culmination of the book then, and this fight in Caesar's Palace in Vegas. I mean, again, things I wouldn't necessarily have known, but you make the point that Vegas in 1985 is, it's not exactly a sweet spot. It's trying to leave the mob years behind, and it's a while away yet from the corporate theme park of the 2000s. So it was kind of a tired city at that stage. What's fascinating, so, is that week, the build-up to the fight. Talk to us about Tommy Hearns, his preparation, and Vegas, because Manny Stewart certainly has his regrets about that week.
Yeah, it was a party atmosphere in Tommy's camp. And there was a tendency for Tommy, like a man who had put in 8 hours at the office at night, he wanted to go out and have a little fun. That was sort of the atmosphere. He figured he had trained all day. At night, he'd go out, do a little gambling, maybe take in a show, maybe hang out with his little gang, of his posse, his entourage. But that was his personality. He liked to keep things sort of lighthearted. He was sort of a happy-go-lucky person. He liked having his buddies around. And it generally kept him in a good mood so he could approach his fights in a sort of an upbeat manner. And there were some who thought he's overdoing it in Vegas because he's getting ready to fight Hagler, who's a dangerous character. There was some thought that Tommy should take things more seriously. But, you know, he had it. He was set in his ways. He was like, I have fun when I'm training. I enjoy Las Vegas. He had fought there a few times in the past. He was going to have fun. Now, the other side of the argument is maybe if he had locked himself in his hotel room at night, it would have been the same fight. You know, he could have taken things more seriously and been more monastic, live like a monk. And Hagler still would have came out charging and knocked him out, you know. Mm. There's no telling if he had been a little more serious, if the fight's outcome would have been any different. People I talk to, and I get a few of them in the book, a few brief comments. They just say, you know, that was Tommy. He was determined to have fun. In future fights, he did take things a little more seriously, but he always had kind of a playful character, a playful persona. He liked practical jokes, you know, his fast cars.
Yeah, because if we fast forward to the scene maybe in the dressing room just before the fight, that's extraordinary, really, because, Manny Stewart doesn't like what he feels is a party atmosphere there. The entourage is way too big. You know, this is a serious place in the moments before a fight like this. And he felt too many people equaled party atmosphere. I think it's, is it Hearns' brother gets in a scuffle with some security guy. So Manny Stewart, who feels he's the best in the business at wrapping the hands, doesn't get to fully wrap Hearns' hands. Again, extraordinary when you think the magnitude of the fight. And that's when, as well, and I don't know if this is connected to Vegas or rumors of overtraining, or you can shed some light on it, hopefully, but it's sort of in the dressing room, and again, this I hadn't realized this, but it's in the dressing room where Hearns comes to the realization that his legs are dead, empty, flat. Somebody tries to start massaging them to get them going, and Manny Stewart recognizes that's a terrible idea. So talk to us about Hearns and his flat legs and his empty legs.
I know, that's sort of the smoking gun of the book. Well, a lot of people at that time simply wrote it off as nerves. And I mentioned that a little bit in the book that, you know, a lot of reporters sort of just jumped to that conclusion. Well, his legs are flat because he was scared. He was nervous. So that, you know, just took it right out of him. But there was also, I also heard from a couple of people, one of them being Harold Knight, who was Stewart's right-hand man for a long time. He claimed that Stewart told him Tommy was doing extra road work without telling anybody, particularly in the early part of training. He was going out at night when he was in Florida. He was training in Florida, running at night, putting in an additional couple of miles on his legs every day. If that's true, well, that would explain a lot. He just wore his legs out. He did say in future fights that he cut back on running because he had done too much running for the Hagler fight. And apparently he was also running on sand. He was running on a beach, which, again, he was doing it without telling Emanuel Stewart. And I got to know Stewart a little bit in the last 5 or 6 years before he died. He was a smart guy. Emanuel Stewart would not be letting Tommy Hearns go out at night to run. He would say, just stay in your room, get some rest. You know, you don't need an additional 3 miles. You don't need to do that. But I think Tommy had it in his head that, you know, because this was such a big fight, he had to overtrain. And he ended up, you know, just coming into the fight really flat. I mean, he looked good. But I think it was a culmination of everything we just said. You know, the party atmosphere, some overtraining, maybe the infamous leg massage. Maybe that played a little bit into it, too. I would say that was just one of many things that played in it. Nerves, sure. He does look a little tight in the opening moments when he first steps through the ropes. He does look a little tight. When you compare it to the way he looked before fighting Durant, if you ever get a chance, go to YouTube if you have time to kill. Look at the way Tommy enters the ring to fight Durant. That's a guy who knows he's about to win.
Okay.
He does not look that way against Hagler.
Okay, interesting. Because, look, perversely, maybe it contributes to this fight being the epic, the short-lived epic that it is, because, you know, according then to Hearns, the game plan has to completely change. You know, any original plan as, you know, the man with the longer reach, although it was interesting to read Hagler's reach much longer, deceptively long for a man of his size, but Hearns is the taller man. Any plan to outbox Hagler and you know, let's dance around here a little bit, that obviously has to go out the window. So he says 15, 20 minutes before this huge fight, because of my legs, I decide now I have to end this fight early. That's like a seismic shift and completely changes the nature of this fight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, imagine having to make that kind of judgment call, you know, before, you know, probably one of the biggest fights of the decade, biggest fight of your life. And you're like, well, I'm not going to be sticking and moving tonight. You know, I have to go out there and try to put him out. That's fascinating to think that just, you know, just minutes before he's thinking about that, you know, they're playing the national anthem and he's thinking, I can't move. My legs are tired. I got to go for the knockout. You know, I guess Hagler, who'd never been knocked.
Yeah. And like, geez, Hagler looks invincible. Like he just looks like he's made of granite. And actually I was amazed. There was an MRI scan, wasn't there, which showed he had like extra padding around his brain. Like, good luck knocking out this guy and his heart.
He just like a little bit of extra bone, right? Right above the ears.
It's useful, I would think, in his line of work. But he just looks ferocious in that fight. Goodness me.
Oh, yeah. And that was another facet that I wanted to dispel in the book. Because as I was digging around and talking to the one remaining member of the Petronellis who is still alive, was Tony Petronelli. There had always been a kind of urban legend that, you know, Hagler hated Tommy so much, you know, and that he just went crazy. And that's why he charged at him like that. But as I researched and learned about this fight, it was all a strategic attack. The whole idea was to keep Hagler coming forward and keep Tommy moving backward. Because they felt Tommy could not do anything moving back. He didn't have the sharpness, the power, the accuracy. If you moved him back, he became a much lesser fighter. So that was why Hagler came out so fast and so furious. It wasn't hate he didn't go crazy at the sound of the bell. But that's the urban myth, and I guess it's more fun to talk about it that way. You still hear guys in bar rooms talking about that fight. They just say, "Oh, Hagler went crazy." You know, it was really not that at all. It was a strategic method that Hagler had actually thought about Joe Frazier, and the way Joe Frazier would, you know, come in low and hard, trying to, you know, break down taller opponents. Like Ali, and he thought that's the style that will beat Tommy Hearns. Mm. The other funny thing is that for all of the buildup and all of the interest in the fight, Hagler's camp never looked at Hearns as a real threat. That was interesting to me. And I think I mentioned it in the book too, is that Goody Petronelli, you know, I asked him one time, in the gym, because I lived not far from that gym, and I got to know Goody a little bit. I said, "What was the attitude going into the fight about Hearns?" And he said, Hearns was a welterweight. We did not have any concern at all. We thought it would go one round."
Oh. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I thought that was fascinating. For all the buildup, all the excitement, they were not at all concerned about that guy.
Yeah. One thing actually I didn't mention, but I hadn't realized either, is that Hagler had this ability to switch seamlessly between orthodox and southpaw and would do it routinely throughout the fight, and was just another weapon in his armory. As for the postscript, it's interesting. Hearns, again, you know, to dispel maybe notions of hatred, Hearns goes into Hagler's dressing room afterwards and offers very sincere congratulations and says some nice things to him, and they go their separate ways. Hagler eventually gets his fight against Sugar Ray and loses. To do an unfair thing and to bluntly kind of try and surmise people's lives, like with Hagler, reading your book and the postscript of the fight, like there is alcohol, there's talk of cocaine, there is domestic violence, there is regular aspirations to get into acting, there's the move to Italy. He does, for a brief period, obviously get... you know, he's on the doing the commercials and he gets the fame he's so cherished. He retires a rich man, you know, going back to the earlier part of our conversation, like 40, 50 million in the bank, very comfortable at the end of his life. But like not all good there, obviously. So how would you, again, in so much as any of us are comfortable surmising 20, 30, 40 years of someone's life, how would you talk about Hagler's post-fighting life?
Well, he did not ride off into the sunset. He had a few bumps along the way. He eventually, you know, he relocated to Italy, which is very, to me, that's very telling about the guy. Part of it was because he was cast in a couple of Italian movies. And he, at the time, he said, "Yeah, this is where the business is. This is where I'm going to." But he was only in a couple of movies, really. Four. He was in four movies in a short time. And yet he stayed in Italy. He married an Italian woman. And I think he did find a sense of peace and quiet, finally. He was good at dealing with people on his terms. That's how he liked it. Some of his best friends did not have his phone number. You know, he was very private. He only wanted to do things on his terms. If it felt right, he'd come to the United States and attend a Hall of Fame event. He might do some color commentary for a fight now and then. He did it in Europe. He worked for, I think, some British broadcasting, maybe some Italian broadcasts. But it was always on his terms. He was no longer seeking the spotlight. If it came to him, he would enjoy it for a short time. But you know, when he died young. He was 66, I think.
Yeah, March of this year, if people hadn't realized. Yeah.
Yeah, he died young, which was sad. when he died, I kept hearing from people who wanted me to know that he was, you know, a nice man and personable. You know, I heard from a lot of people who said, oh, I ran into him in a supermarket and he gave me his autograph and was very charitable, very kind. So it seems like he you know, I hate to say he mellowed out with his older years. But I think he did. I think he got a chance to taste fame, the fame that he had craved. And it backfired on him a little bit. He decided he didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
But he did. He was able to enjoy the benefits of it.
Okay. Yeah. Thomas Hearn's still alive. Tommy Hearn's still alive. Falling out with Manny Stewart, which is quite sad, and it was over money. So Hearn's post-fight, the effect of this fight on Hearn's, I mean, I'm sure he had to relive it far more than he liked. It's easier for, I mean, none of us like kind of being defined by our past, but I guess it's easier if you're a haggler and you've managed to win one of the great fights of all time. Tommy Hearns has to relive losing it. Was he able to cope with that?
I think it remains sort of a thorn in his side that he never got a rematch.
Yeah.
It wasn't so, I don't think he's angry that he lost. I think he's angry that he didn't get a rematch. Because the two other key fights that he lost, to Leonard and to Iran Barkley, he had rematches. And he did well. You know, a lot of people think he defeated Leonard in their rematch, though it was called a draw by the judges. But a lot of people think Tommy won that one. And I think Tommy was satisfied with his performance in the rematch with Leonard. Against Barkley, he lost a split decision, but he sent Barkley to the hospital with some injuries. He showed that he could go toe-to-toe with these guys.
Yeah.
And I think that's all he wanted with Hagler, was a chance to show, I can do it. I'm not going to get knocked out. I can trade punches with this guy. I can go the distance.
Because so yes, sorry to interrupt. Like, again, my fault, a key point not to mention. In this three-round fight, he does walk back to his corner at the end of the first round with a broken right hand. You mentioned his tendency to have these issues. So, I mean, again, watching it today, again, in advance of talking to you, when you watch rounds two and three, and probably a portion of one, knowing that this guy has a broken right hand.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it makes it a more wince-inducing experience. It's extraordinary bravery.
Oh, yeah. It shows you that he was, you know, I don't like to use the expression warrior.
Sure.
You know, because there are real warriors out there who are in real wars. But, you know, he did have that big, brave warrior mentality. You know, yeah. And he never got a chance to fight Hagler a second time. Now, a lot of people I talk to say that Hagler would have defeated him a second time.
Mm.
But in the book, I do play devil's advocate just a little bit. And I suggest that had they fought a second time, Hagler would have been a little bit older, because he looked flat against Leonard. He didn't have the same kind of snap that he had just a year or two earlier. Mm. He looked a little flat. He was getting older.
Mm.
And Tommy was getting more accustomed to fighting at middleweight. And his body was filling out. He was getting stronger. So I do give Tommy a little bit of a chance in a rematch. I think he may have done, I don't know if he would win, but maybe he would have done what he did in his other rematches. Maybe he would have gone the distance, kept it close, maybe even steal a few rounds. Could have been interesting. And I don't think it was an automatic replay of the first fight.
Okay, interesting. And how has he spent his retirement? I mean, we alluded to maybe a bit more ostentatious with his money than Hagler and the falling out with Stewart. So is he sitting on a huge nest egg? Is he comfortable, or where is he in his life?
Well, from what I heard, he still has his big house. He's not rolling in money, I don't think. But he's done what a lot of older athletes do. He goes on the autograph circuit, signing at memorabilia shows, things like that. I actually saw him a few months ago at, there was a memorial service for Hagler. And I live in Massachusetts, so I wasn't too far from it. I thought, well, I called my publisher and I said, let's go down and pay our respects, you know. And Hearns happened to be there. Now, he didn't speak, which is telling. You know, I think he has some issues now with he doesn't sound as clear as he might have okay. in the past. Boxing as many fights as he had. I think he had well over 60, maybe 70 fights, and they were a lot of rough ones.
Okay.
He has some health issues. He moves around well. He still looked big and imposing, but his speech is maybe not as great as it used to be. But he was there. He was signing autographs, shaking hands with people. He looked physically healthy. Mm. He was moving pretty well. He wasn't shuffling staggering. He was moving pretty well. I think he's okay. I don't think we have to feel sorry for him. I know there were some issues with his family. He lends his money out to a lot of people. There's a lot of that going on. For the most part, I think Tommy's okay. He still occasionally makes the appearance with Ray Leonard now and then. They'll appear together somewhere. I think he would have liked to do that sort of thing with Hagler. Maybe make some appearances with Hagler over the years. They only made a couple. There was the opening of a Kronk gym in England, I think. And they appeared together there with Stewart. But Marvin was never really in a hurry to relive the past. He said that was in 1985. We did our thing. We don't have to keep doing it. Hagler was, you know, now is now. We're living now. I don't have to keep doing that. I think Tommy might have liked it, though. And in fact, there's a great story in the book about the two of them at a hotel during a Hall of Fame induction weekend where they were entertaining children in the hallway, you know, kids who did not know who they were, you know, and they were just happily playing with the kids, you know. So that I thought that was a nice little story from Al Bernstein, who I don't know how well you know Bernstein in Ireland, but he's a big name in America as a broadcaster.
Yeah.
He told me this story about Hagler and Hearns just entertaining his son for the weekend. His son didn't know who they were. His son was not a boxing fan. It was just his little kid. And Tommy and Marvin, almost felt obligated to show the kid, a good time. Because I've been up there in the summer for those Hall of Fame inductions. And in the middle of June, the weather is always hot. It can be, while you're waiting for the ceremony, it can get a little boring. And I thought, well, that shows you something about Marvin and Tommy. That, they would just kind of put their guard down and entertain a little kid for a weekend. I thought that was telling of their characters.
Mm, yeah. Maybe a novelty not to meet someone who wants something from them, I guess, as well. Don Stradley, The War, Hagler Hearns, and Three Rounds for the Ages. I will hold it up again there. Well worth a read. If you're listening to this and you haven't watched this 8-minute fight, I guarantee you have spent 8 minutes on worse things. So go on to YouTube there and have a watch. It's long overdue. Don Stradic, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it and great to have you on Off the Ball. Cheers.
Thank you very much. And thank you for reading the book. That always makes the interview a lot better if I'm talking to someone who has taken a moment to read the book. I love that.
No. My pleasure. Thanks, Don.
Thank you.